Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a program that every week explores the economic dimensions of our lives, our jobs, our incomes, our debts, the future jobs and incomes of our kids, all those parts of life we call economics. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics at several institutions across my lifetime, and I currently teach at the New School University in New York City. I also write columns of economic analysis for several publications, including Truthout. And I would urge you to take a look at truthout.org, a remarkable, independent source of economic and other kinds of news and analysis available every day at truthout.org. Let me also direct you, as I always do, to the two websites that we maintain, where you can get more of the kind of analysis you get on this program, interviews, media opportunities that I have, classes I've taught, and so on. The first one is rdwolf with two F's .com, and the second one is democracyatwork.info. Both of those websites are available 24/7, no charge at all, and both of them give you two added opportunities you might want to take advantage of. First, both of them have ways for you to communicate to us, to tell us what you like and don't like about the program, questions you'd like me to deal with, all of that kind of reaction you have, input you want to how this program gets structured. We cannot answer them all, but we read every one and use it to organize and design the program. And the other thing both websites give you is a way to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. Simply click on those icons at either website, and we will be in more continuous touch with you on an ongoing basis. Let me begin this program by thanking many of you. I appeared on the 25th of July with Bill Maher on his television program, Live, Real Time. And he and I had a conversation about topics of the sort we cover on this program over the first 8 or 9 minutes of that program, and then again on the internet program that follows his regular TV show. And I really have been very impressed by the kinds of feedback many of you have chosen to send us. And please, if you have thoughts about that appearance, again, critical or celebratory or something in between, don't hesitate to let us know. It's very important for us as well. I was, of course, honored and flattered by being invited to go out to LA and do that program by the Bill Maher organization. Updates we can begin with. Well, fast food workers are in the news this last week, the end of July and beginning of August 2014. First was a meeting in a suburb of Chicago that gathered 1,300 fast food workers from around the country, brought together to discuss their strategy in trying to move from the $7 and $8 and $9 an hour level of wages that nobody can survive on to the $15 minimum an hour that is their goal and target and has been of actions now for quite some time. And the interesting thing that was decided at this meeting, which was gathered in part by the Service Employees International Union, the SEIU, was a decision reached by these folks representing many parts of the country that they're going to up the ante. They're going to go from demonstrations and petitions and so on to a program that includes civil disobedience specifically and occupying restaurants. To make clear that they are determined to get a living, decent income for the work that they do and not to be as exploited as these companies and these employers have imposed on them for a long time. The second thing that affected fast food workers was a ruling by the National Labor Relations Board in Washington, the NLRB, that made a very interesting determination. The determination had to do with McDonald's, one of the largest employers of fast food workers in the world. And the ruling said that McDonald's cannot continue to be exempt from the struggles between workers and employers. What had been done before, and this is typical for many large companies with retail outlets, is that McDonald's took a step back. It created what is known as the franchise system, together with other corporations, been around quite a while, this system. And in effect, what McDonald's does is create a buffer between itself as the company that controls and operates the hamburger empire that it runs, and the actual employer in each case. In that case, in these situations, the actual employer is a local person who owns one or a few McDonald's restaurants. That person is called a franchisee. And technically, legally, that's the employer. But of course, a tight contract connects that employer, the local owner, to the big monster corporation. And basically, if you want to have a McDonald's restaurant, you are bound to do pretty much everything the way McDonald's tells you to do, even though technically you buy from McDonald's the hamburger that you then resell to the retail customer, you buy the napkins, you buy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You put up some of your own money, which is nice for McDonald's, and you take a lot of risk that this doesn't work out, which is also nice for McDonald's, and it has other implications. McDonald's can claim it's not responsible for whatever policies the local franchisee imposes on his or her workers. And it is also a peculiar way that messes up the statistics in this country, because each of these little owners is considered a small business, so that you get the idea that, oh, America is a place where there are lots of small businesses. Well, maybe, but these small businesses are in hock up to their eyebrows to a big monster business, McDonald's. They are really not independent. They're really not independent small businesses. The ruling by the National Labor Relations Board is important because it ruled that McDonald's is part of the ownership, even if there's a franchisee between the big corporation and the workers. And the reason that's important is that the struggles of the workers now can be struggles demanding things of McDonald's as a legitimate counterparty to what the union wants. They can't be put away, or the workers can't be put away, by saying you simply deal with the local person. McDonald's wipes its hands. It forces McDonald's into the picture, and that is a major gain for the unions because, of course, McDonald's has the wealth and the power that the workers have always had to confront if they're really going to make a difference. Okay, second big item that I wanted to talk to you about was the report over the last week that in the second quarter of 2014, that's the second three-month period of the year, economic growth in the United States was at 4% per year, a number that is much larger than it typically has been over the last many years. And it's was particularly welcome because in the first quarter of 2014, economic growth, according to the government, was minus 2.9%. So if you put the two quarters together with the adjustments that were announced, we have, again, what we've had the last several years. Economic growth in the range of 2 to 2.5% on an annual basis. That is poor. That does not solve our economic problems. It does not change the depressed condition of the American economy. In particular, if you look at the numbers a little more closely, a huge part of what even the growth was that we had was a growth in inventories. That's when companies buy more stuff to put on their shelves. But now the question will be, can they sell it off their shelves? Because if they can't, then the growth, economic growth, is going to shrink again. Bottom line, we are in a long-term economic crisis, and nothing that has happened so far in 2014 changes that in a basic way, and that's been true now for several years. I want to go on to tell you a story about something that's happening in the world today that teaches us a very important economic lesson. This economic update has to do with Salt Lake City in the state of Utah, the major metropolis in that state. Let's quickly see what's going on. Salt Lake City is a city of about 190,000 people. So it's a sizable, large city by American standards. It has changed recently, so that, which I found remarkable, 25% of the population of Salt Lake is of Hispanic origin. It has a sizable minority population. What I want to talk to you about are the two newspapers that serve, daily newspapers that serve Salt Lake City. The first is called the Salt Lake Tribune, which has about 61,000 readers per day. And the second one is the Deseret News, which has about 40,000 readers per day. The Salt Lake Tribune is a privately owned, non-denominational newspaper. The Deseret News is owned and operated by the Mormon Church, a powerhouse in the state of Utah. Who exactly owns the Salt Lake Tribune? Well, it's owned by something called Digital First Media, which in turn is controlled by a hedge fund in New York City called the Alden Global Capital Corporation. And here's what they've been doing. They've been cutting staff over the last year or so. They've been working out deals with the Deseret News. And it looks to many of the people in Salt Lake, including those who contacted me, that the Salt Lake Tribune may be moving to stop publication. This would be, for many people in Salt Lake, an unwanted situation. Why? Well, the basic reason, in terms of the research I did, is the following. The Salt Lake Tribune is your average American newspaper, fairly objective, fairly open to a variety of perspectives, whereas the Deseret News, owned and operated by the Mormon Church, is, and I'll be as polite as I can, quite conservative in how it treats the news and what it covers and how it covers it. So there have been growing anxieties from the Hispanic community, from the gay community, and from many others in Salt Lake, that what they're facing is a situation where something as basic as the daily newspaper that folks depend on is being phased out so that there will be only one newspaper left owned and operated by the Mormon Church. Well, you might think that something as important as a non-denominational, independent daily newspaper is something that the society of the United States would want to preserve and maintain in one of its larger cities. But the fact of the matter is that's not happening. There is no authority to deal with something as important as a daily newspaper, to make sure a community has it, to make sure a community has a reasonably objective and open-minded newspaper. So what's going to happen is that the 190,000 people of Salt Lake will have or not have a daily newspaper, depending on a struggle between a hedge fund in New York seeking to make money off of its ownership of a newspaper, on the one hand, and a church with its own mission and its own objectives, on the other. I ask you to think with me, do we really want to live in a society where the daily newspaper, the source of news about what is happening in our community, it is going to be determined by a struggle between those wanting to make money and those wanting to push a religious agenda? It's not what the founding fathers meant by freedom of the press, at least not in any interpretation I'm familiar with. The next item that just caught my attention, and this has to do with something we did discuss last week when I brought to your attention the market basket struggle of workers in that food supermarket chain in New England, and I brought to you also that interesting action by the people in Seattle to prevent the foreclosure against a disabled U.S. veteran. Here's another story that I think tells us something about what's happening to workers in America. This one has to do with Chicago. And the company in question in Chicago is the Water Saver Faucet Company. And it faced a demonstration over the last week by its employees. They have 80 factory workers that make faucets in Chicago. Why were they demonstrating? Answer, they are allowed by policy of the management 6 minutes a day to use the bathroom. Not only is that the limit, but they get a card, each employee does, of the 80, and they have to swipe the card each time they enter a restroom so that the company can monitor that they don't use a restroom for more than 6 minutes a day. The workers said, no, we're not going to be treated this way. We're just not. And I think what's interesting is not what the company is doing. That's a sign of companies across America that think that in this current climate of the relative weakness of the labor movement, of the kind of gung-ho, let's go for the big bacon mentality of corporate leaders, that they can do literally whatever they want, even if it means giving you a card to control how long you take to relieve yourself in the bathroom. And the workers won't take it. And they fought back, and they're not going to accept it. And it shook up the management, and it's not yet clear what the final outcome is going to be, but I think it's an interesting sign that workers are not willing to be as passive as they have recently been, are beginning to recognize that they want, need, and deserve some real say about what is happening at the workplace where they are employed. And I, for one, think it's very good to see that kind of thing happening. Okay. I am proud today to say that I have a guest with me. She has been a guest on this program before, and some of you know that her work and mine overlap from time to time. She is Dr. Harriet Fraud. She is a mental health counselor and hypnotherapist. She's been in practice, private practice, with people coming to see her for over 40 years. And the last 10 years has had a thriving private practice in New York City. Among her many interests are a concern to help people who are struggling with the economic and political conditions of a changing America and are concerned about the impact of those conditions on their personal lives, their relationships, the intimate parts of all of our lives. And that's what I've asked her to come and talk with us about, because I think she can teach us important things. So first of all, Dr. Harriet Fraud, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So let me begin with a little bit of background of what it is I hope you can teach us today. As I have often talked about, the real wage in the United States, that is how much money a worker gets adjusted for the prices he or she has to pay, hasn't changed in about 30 or 40 years. It's amazing. The productivity of workers, what they give to the employer, has kept going up, but what the employer gives them, their real wage, is flat, which is why we've had a stock market boom, which is why our inequality is as great as it has been. But it still leaves the impression that workers are getting the same bundle of goods and services today that they got 30 years ago, and so the assumption might be, well, we're not better off, but most workers are the same. And yet, it isn't the case.
No.
Workers all know, as thousands of emails coming to me attest, and all the statistics show, that somehow workers know that their situation has deteriorated over the last 30 or 40 years, hasn't remained the same, not even close. So my attention was caught, and so was, by the way, Bill Maher's, because that's one of the topics he raised with me on his program last week. We're caught by a story in USA Today, a major American newspaper, actually on their July 4th issue, where they did a study, careful study, and they said, what would it cost a family of four in the United States to have a modest version of the American dream? A car, a home, a college education for their kids, nothing fancy, not the most expensive of any of these things, but a modest one. And the results of USA Today on the 4th of July were published, and it said it would cost $130,000 for a family of four to have a modest version of the American dream. A less modest version would cost $150,000. But let's stay with the lower, the most modest, $130,000. And then the USA Today article dropped the bomb, in a sense. They pointed out that only one out of eight American households earns $130,000 a year, which means 7 out of 8 households in America cannot have the American dream. They cannot provide to their household, the parents can't provide to each other or to the children, this modest version of the American dream. That wasn't true in the 1970s. So what I want to ask you is, can you help us understand how even though wages, what you could buy together, stayed the same, the actual condition of American households and of the American people has become harder and harder, the way the USA article describes. And tell us why that is, and tell us a little bit about what it does to people, how it affects them. That's what your expertise as a psychologist really is, I think, important to our listeners.
Yeah, I think that it's important because the value of the typical household has gone down by a third. There was an article to that effect as well. And so in this great recovery, people, the average, you know, not the average, but the typical household brings in $56,000, less than half of what a reasonable middle class life would be like. And so that's not obviously a recovery. And so we have to look at what happened and why isn't it reflected? Why isn't the real wage buying the real package it used to? Well, part of it is that there's a host of things squeezing the money out of American people as capitalism in its octopus stage is choking people. Here are just a few things. Government services have been cut. Well, that's an abstraction. Government services have been cut. All right. Well, look at what it means when spots for kindergartners are cut. When after school programs and after school sports programs for kids are cut. When preschools are cut. When daycare costs as much as it does. Well, daycare costs as much as an average community college salary, and that's cheap daycare. If you want a quality daycare, for example, a friend of mine's grandchildren just got a good deal with a really good quality daycare in San Francisco. She has twins, her grandchildren are twins, and so they got two kids for only $43,000 a year for preschool. This isn't even school. So that where public programs are cut, then people have to pay for care, and 85% of kids are in substandard care for daycare. What does it mean? It means wet babies are sitting parked in front of television and being ignored in the formative years of brain formation, 0 to 2 years old.
So let me interrupt you. So part of, as an economist, part of what you're saying, which is very important, is that when the government cuts back on the services it provides people, it forces people to have to now buy things commercially that used to be delivered to them without expenditure, so that even if they're earning the same amount of money in terms of buying goods and services, they have to buy new and different goods and services to make up for what the government isn't providing.
That's exactly
and
it.
And that then means if they spend on their children, there's really less for the other things in life.
Exactly. So that, you know, after school program cuts mean that because almost all mothers work outside the home, 60% of mothers with kids under 3 years old are in the labor force working mostly full time, that children are left alone. And if they're left alone, that means you have to buy video games, computer games, Game Boys.
So again, new things that have to be bought.
Have to be bought for these kids. There has to be a cell phone at the home, so if something disaster happens, you can call the parent at work. You need different security in the household, different kinds of locks and other security systems. And that goes all the way up. Need blind admissions, which used to be part of Harvard, are cut. So if you don't have the money, you don't go, even if you were scholarly enough to get in. Elder care programs, which are cut, mean that people have to leave their elderly relatives alone or somehow fork out the money. And it has to be remembered, since mothers have been forced economically, as well as some people want the benefit of an independent income, but whether they want it or not, mothers have been forced into the labor force. Women have been forced into the labor force. And so you don't have the mother at home who's going to look in on your kids if you happen to be away for a while or you happen to be working.
So again,
that's gone.
So again, there's a whole new set of expenditures to compensate for the mother having to be away, et cetera, et cetera.
That's right. And for that lack of collectivity of people at home who can go away for a day and watch their kids.
Can I just underscore it? Because I know this was a point that Elizabeth Warren made, the senator from Massachusetts, kind of famous for that, of trying to get across to people that the growing number of dollars that American workers had to spend didn't make any difference to their growing difficulty because they had so many things they now had to spend on that they didn't have to spend on before, that the extra spending shouldn't be understood as, oh, people are having luxurious lives. On the contrary, they're having to spend money for stuff that they used to either not need or was provided by the government or in some other way socially taken care of that's no longer available.
That's no longer there. So if your kid wanted to be in the band, the cuts to the school mean either there is no band or they have to buy their own instrument or rent it. They don't get it from the school. Right. That's a big expenditure. So it means sacrificing your kid or sacrificing yourself.
But it isn't an expansion in your standard of living.
It's actually a detraction. And just as the field trips used to be accomplished through discretionary spending in the schools, the cuts to the schools mean parents have to pay for the field trip. If they can't pay, their kid can't go.
Right.
That there's, you know...
Which has, by the way, as I hope you'll go into a little bit later, it has enormous psychological implications
on those children
that are left behind.
Absolutely, because their parents can't pay, so they're inferior.
Right.
The same idea is that people who... Children are more and more pressured by the advertising industry. So, you know, the kind of clothes that kids want so that they can fit in, so they can be prestigious, have changed. Starting in preschool, having the right sneakers really matters. And look at these kinds of prices people are paying. Jordan Air Max for preschool girls, $74.99. Nike Kobe 10 EM teen boys favorites, $159.99.
For one pair of sneakers.
For one pair of sneakers. And, well, that was $74.99 for preschoolers. Teen boys are going to get their shoes all messed up, $159.99. Grade school boys, and these are the new sneakers that the kids want and that kids get prestige for wearing. Nike Air Max LeBrons for school-age boys, $134.99. There's all sorts of pressures to have the right computer apps, to have the right games. And if you don't...
The telephone, too, the cell phone.
To have a cell phone, you know, that if you don't have that, you're one down. And that doesn't even count the after-school programs that are cut, so your kid can't take the lessons they want. They're
cooped up in your house. That was your point earlier, that the kids feel
inferior.
Denied. They feel inferior because they can't participate in the way that used to be part of what a school did. It treated all the kids the same. They all went on the trip, and they all felt part of the community. Now you're wrenching people apart, and the children have to try to make sense of what it is deficient about their parents that makes them have to stay
and
at home.
They have to feel inferior as other kids are getting the prestige for having these things they don't have. And this is not only for children, of course, but the cuts in road maintenance mean that those people who don't not fortunate enough like we are in New York to be in a place where there's
public transportation
constantly faulty, but better public transportation, have wear and tear on their cars. The cars aren't maintained. Or they hit a pothole. Who's going to pay for the damage? Not the city that didn't maintain the roads, not the federal government, but the individual.
So it's another transfer. The people who want the government to spend less money often leave out the implication that if the government
that
does...
That everyone else has to spend more money.
Yeah, that they don't see the connection with the rising things you have to buy as an individual, which you don't have the money to pay for, so that therefore cutting the government budget is not a wise move because the taxes you would have had to pay to get that done collectively by the government are less then your losses from having to make up privately for what the government no
That's
longer
provides. That's exactly right. And even if there is some corruption, there is everywhere. So every corporation. So what? Things were maintained better. People didn't have the personal cost. If you, for example, using that same area, if you don't maintain the roads because you have cut the funds, then you finally have to. The bridge collapses, the road collapses, then you have to a detour. And who pays for the gas? Yeah. And who pays for the wear on the tear? The individuals right. who are affected.
Let me interrupt you here because we need to take our mid-program break.
Okay.
We've been talking about the greater difficulty and how it begins to impact families and how they want. I'd like to, when we come back from our short break, push you a little bit, if I can, towards talking about the personal psychological implications of all of these. How does that make people feel? Because in the end, the economy is supposed to make people have a better life, not keep posing more and more problems. In any case, folks, we're about to take our break. This is Richard Wolff. This is Economic Update. I'm with our guest, Dr. Harriet Fraud, a practicing health counselor and mental health counselor. Please join us. We'll be back in a very few seconds to do the second half of our program. Welcome back. This is the second half of Economic Update. I am Richard Wolff. I want to remind you that if this program and what we do here interests you, we maintain two websites that I invite you to make use of, rdwolff.com and democracyatwork.info. I'm talking today with my guest, Dr. Harriet Fraud, and she also maintains a website if you're interested in what is going on in this program. You might want to pursue that as well. Her website is Harriet Fraud. I'll spell it HarrietFraad, HarrietFraad.com. Okay, before the break, we were talking about how to explain and understand what the USA Today on July 4th reported, which is that the vast majority of Americans can no longer afford, given the income they earn, anything like the American dream. So I want you to pick up where you left off.
Well, one thing that I want to say is that one of the things they don't count when they say real wages have stayed the same, and yet, of course, the typical household has lost a third of its value, and that value allows them to have less than half of what you need for a reasonable middle-class life. And that is that
doesn't... By the way, let me just make sure everybody understands that. The median household income in the United States now is around $51,000 per household. So that's median means 50% of Americans have less than that, 50% more. Keep that in your mind when I remind you that according to USA Today, July of this year, a modest version of the American dream requires $130,000. So it doesn't take rocket science to understand the vast majority of American households cannot anymore afford anything remotely like the so-called American dream.
Yes, and that's called recovery. And one of the things it doesn't count, which I just want to say before moving on, is that we have a number of men incarcerated in the United States where we lead the industrialized world. Our rate of incarceration is between 5 and 8 times what any other developed nation has. And that means that 1 out of every 3 young African American males doesn't contribute to his family and doesn't get a wage. They are slave labor if they're working, or near slave labor as they work as prisoners. 1 out of 30 white young men are in the same position, so they're not making any wage.
Right.
So you're not being counted as
even though the wage, right, the wage per person is constant. A larger and larger number of persons over the last 30 years are pulled out of the very community that refers to, and they contribute little or nothing.
Exactly. And not only are they pulled out, they're pulled out with the social
stigma
and to themselves and their families that they are in jail, and with the social knock on the head that makes it very hard for them ever to make a living because they have that problem. And so what we have, if we look at then, what does this mean? Well, the basic unit for emotional stability in the United States was the family. That is basically falling apart on a level it never did. In 1965, Patrick Moynihan in his Racism said that the problem with the African American family, why so many fathers were absent, why it wasn't as strong a family, was because of the inherent pathology of African American men. Well, as it turns out, that's the pattern now in the United States, where 42% of kids, of all kinds of kids on average, are born outside of a marriage, and where the majority, 3/4 of Americans, what they call prime marriageable ages, 18 to 34, aren't married and don't plan to be. So that unit is pretty much out. A lot of people want to get married, but they're not because they don't have the money, they don't see the future, and they're not getting married. And also because the old deal that men could support women in the household creating children, that's gone.
So, but the powerful point, if I get it correctly, is that Moynihan blamed that on something peculiar to the African-American family and the African-American community. What we're seeing now, what the economic development of the United States teaches us, is what was really going on was that African-American men back then were denied the economic opportunities they needed to be the kinds of fathers and husbands they wanted to. When you deny that to white people, the way it's happening in the last 30 years, bingo, you get the same result. The family falls apart. So it had nothing to do with African American versus Caucasian. It had to do with what kind of economic pressures you put on people, then you get the social result.
That's right, because if you didn't have a family wage, you couldn't support a family. Now, I personally think that the kind of families that were considered viable, of dependent wives and children and wage earning males that were available for
the
all
traditional
but my
family,
minorities, were terrible.
Right.
Men were in, you know, had to serve until they died. And women and men who were women had to be subordinate and had to stay in unhappy marriages in order to because they had no support for themselves and
no
their children
option.
And no options. Neither men were denied the joy of interacting with children and having close emotional relationships and a gender expansion to be a full human being. Women were denied economic and political power and have the full expansion to be a full human being. However, as women are in the workforce everywhere else, they have in other developed countries excellent quality child care and after school care, subsidies for single mothers, all sorts of programs of support, apartments built with communal dining and people participating to create a social environment very different. So that those chances, those changes could be welcomed and not cause enormous disruption in relationships if they were handled in a social way. And instead, social services have been cut rather than expanded for people. And so what has happened is interesting because it's really different what has happened for women as what has happened for men. Because women retain their traditional gender roles of nurturing and caring for children and being emotionally close to one another and making social and emotional connections. men who usually had their sexually connected female be the one who made their emotional connection for them, was tied to a sexual connection so they could feel macho about it, no longer have that. And women have gained new skills in economic and political power. Men have lost a standing and a supremacy they once had and are quite desperate. And so
let me just make sure for the audience and for myself, so that over the last 30 years or 40 years, this crunching down on the financial viability of the family has not only affected in the ways we've discussed, but changed the whole relationship between men and women. The men have had less and less of the standing that goes with being the breadwinner. As the family survival requires the woman to work, she gets more standing, has a sense of herself as at least in some ways expanding and growing, whereas he has a sense of shrinkage, and that this is causing enormous tensions for both individuals and for their relationship.
That's absolutely right. And what has happened is that people are quite desperate, and men in particular are quite desperate, which is one of the reasons all of the serial killers, except for one who was an ideological fascist woman, who with her boyfriend killed five people, but that they're all men. And they're overwhelmingly white men. And as I studied them for over the last 6 months, the things that had happened in their lives recently were they had lost jobs or they had lost relationships. So because men didn't learn, women had a women's movement behind us to encourage us to have a fuller life. Men didn't learn how to maintain emotional relationships and connections with each other. You know, coming here, I saw two women looking at each other and they, oh, hi, you know, they hugged each other. Then we saw two guys, you know, bumping shoulders and staying stiff. That the emotional connection, the emotional neediness that used to be fulfilled through a female-male relationship isn't there. So men are quite desperate. And one of the things, there have been five big developments in personal life that have illustrated this. And those are additional to small things like testosterone creams that have gone through the roof to help men feel more like men. But these things that have changed is one of them is the culture of the military, which in its economic draft allows men who can't make a living very well to join the military into a macho organization that, in spite of their ostensible campaign, had a 50% increase in rapes over the years in which they were trying to ostensibly do something about rape. You also have the evangelical religions that used to be bigger than they are now, they're dwindling, in which men were considered dominant and women subordinate, and women were supposed to take care of hearth and home even if they had to make all the money. That's another reason they're diminishing. Another one is the men's rights associations. So I listened on Rush Limbaugh where this guy says, I'm confused, my wife left me, I feel that. He says, she's a feminazi. That's why there are these groups called Men's Rights Association that tell men it's not the outsourcing for capitalist profit. It's not the mechanizing for capitalist profit or the robotizing or the converting your job into a temporary job for capitalist profit. It's the feminazis. It's the minorities. It's immigrants who are taking away your manhood and you've got to get revenge. And they actually encourage men to do vengeful things against women and sometimes celebrate killers who have killed women. So that's a phenomenon, the Men's Rights Association. And the biggest of all is pornography, because heterosexual pornography is pornography in which there is a dominant male and a subordinate female who enjoys all sorts of things that a woman any other way would find degrading. You know, 10 cum shots on her face. Not too many people are up for that. And so you have this very profitable industry, pornography, $17 billion industry, selling people a substitute for personal interaction. So even in the most intimate interaction, a capitalist product is intervening and reinforcing men who feel dispossessed by the capitalist system, but are believing it's because of uppity women that they're dispossessed and they recapture their manhood. So what you do, you have this disintegration of personal life, particularly for men who were connected through women. And then you have capitalist products and the military, the most profitable of all. $1 trillion is spent to come in and give men a warped sense of manhood, along with the NRA, I forgot to mention them, with the shoot your girlfriend option, where you can obliterate the ex-girlfriend game or substitute your manhood for a Bushmaster assault weapon, that sell, I want to emphasize, sell for capitalist profit a manhood that is outmoded and sad and denies men connection and emotional care and love and a sense of being emotionally connected. And so these are the capitalist phenomena that are happening to disrupt and distort personal life in America. Nothing's as personal as making love. But 10 million American men are porn addicts who have substituted the capitalist product of pornography from any interest in an interpersonal relationship, even in sex.
Harriet, one of the reasons I invited you, which you have fulfilled more than I even hoped for, is precisely to make it clear that the economic changes that we talk about on this program are not just important in terms of what they say about our jobs, our incomes, and our family household finances, but they have enormous implications on our personal lives, on the daily feelings, literally the relationships that make life what it is, and that to understand what is happening in this society economically is really only the beginning of beginning to see what the ramifications, what the implications are, because the end result, I hope, is to give people an even deeper sense of the changes that need to be understood and talked about and made, because our lives literally depend on it. And so thank you very, very much for just opening that door a little bit to the psychological dimensions of what's happening.
Thank you.
Okay, folks, in the time that remains, I'm going to respond to a couple of your questions that we selected, as we usually do. The first question is, many of you have heard me go over the story of how in the 1930s, Franklin Roosevelt, our president then, decided that he was going to do something for the mass of people, create Social Security, unemployment compensation, a minimum wage for the first time, hiring millions of people on the federal payroll to do work, and to pay for it all by taxing corporations and the rich. And we've compared him to Obama, and Obama didn't do those things, didn't help the mass of people, and did not tax corporations and the rich. And the question is, how was Roosevelt capable? How was he able to convince the United States Congress to tax rich people for such purposes? And correspondingly, why was Obama unable to do it? Okay, there's a simple answer. It's a long and complex history, of course, but it's a simple answer. Roosevelt went to the Congress as he went to the rich and the well-connected and the corporate leaders, and he was able to point to something they could see on the evening news, in the newspaper. Didn't have TV back then, but he could point to the pictures in the newspaper. He could point to the radio programs. And what was he pointing to? Millions of people in the streets, organized by the CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organizations, a powerful new union organizing wave that organized millions of people, to the Socialist parties, two of them, and the Communist Party of the United States, all working together, but most importantly, leading and representing many millions of active American adults. And he basically said to the Congress, we have to do something or else there's going to be a revolution. Sometimes he used the word, more usually privately, but sometimes he didn't. It didn't matter. They all saw those newspaper stories. They all watched the people marching in the streets outside their homes. They all had members of their families caught up in these new union and political movements. That's why he was able to convince the Congress. They did what Roosevelt wanted because they feared what would happen to them if they didn't. And the answer about Obama is simple. He didn't have that. The unions have been shrinking for 50 years. There is no upsurge in union organization in the United States that will confront Mr. Obama. He's a political leader at a time of weakness of the labor movement. There's no polite way to get around saying that. And the Communist and Socialist parties were destroyed after the Second World War by concerted police repression. There's no polite way to get around saying that either. So we don't have the union movement, the socialists, or the communists. And we don't have anything that arose in their place. So this president doesn't have that. The closest that might have happened, and I think this is what the questions sometimes aim at, what might have happened is if Mr. Obama, having learned the lesson of Roosevelt, understood that in order for him to be able to get a program to tax the rich past Congress, in order to get them to help the mass of people, to do what Roosevelt did, Obama would have to go out and actively help develop the mass movement that arose independently and confronted Roosevelt. And Obama had that opportunity. He could have done that. Obama could have done something like Roosevelt did. He could have done it if he had responded to the Occupy Wall Street movement and become its champion, its supporter. Imagine Obama traveling around the country saying that he is going to rally people to achieve the kind of mass support by taxing the rich and the corporations, the way his predecessor President Roosevelt did. The polls indicate in America, and they have for years, that the majority of people support that program. The majority of people want corporations and the rich to carry a much bigger load of the tax burden, and they want help from the government during these difficult economic times. He could have championed that. He might have then developed the movement, which he could then have pointed to as the reason why Congress should do for him what the Congress did for Roosevelt. Mr. Obama chose not to go in that direction. And that's why the story of Obama is as different as imaginable from the story of Roosevelt. Second and final question we'll have time for, and it goes something like this. If businesses in the 1930s, or even businesses today, were confronted with a movement of the sort I just described, a movement to tax them at high rates, the way they once were in the 1950s and 60s, in order to really help people, in order to do things for Americans precisely of the sort that Harriet Fraud just described not being there with all of the awful social consequences. So this question is, if that happened, why wouldn't we face a situation where the businesses would simply say, if you dare to tax us at high rates, we'll just leave. We will just go someplace else where the taxes haven't been raised, and you'll be real sorry for having dared to make us pay. Well, I always find this question amazing, because the question is raised as if the people and the government of the people don't have any tools or weapons at their disposal to respond to a business community or a wealthy community that dared to suggest it would not be bound by the democratically arrived at decisions and would leave. Let me be real blunt here. A company that responded to raise the democratically arrived at higher tax rates by trying to leave the country would be evading its responsibility. And the government has more than enough power to pass the regulations and the laws to make any such behavior criminal. In which case, a company that tried to leave would find marshals arriving at the door, informing the company that they no longer owned or operated these enterprises. They could move their office to another country, have a nice day. But what the government was going to do was to preserve the jobs and preserve the production by, guess what?
organizing a worker co-op and having the government provide the workers who want to keep their jobs here in this country and are willing, more than willing, to pay their fair share of taxes. Let us continue to have our economy, and let these companies know, if you want to leave, be our guest. You go. But your production facilities, they're not going to be abandoned. You're not going to be able to bring products you produce elsewhere back into the country, because they're going to face the competition of the workers and the enterprises still going here. In other words, if the government legitimately and democratically raises taxes on corporations and the rich, and they threaten to evade their democratic responsibilities by leaving, then you leave no recourse to the government and the people but to pass the laws that prevent them from doing that, because that is to deny their obligations as American corporations. They're free to leave if they want to go to another country. They're even free to move some of their assets. But the basic jobs and productions that they threaten to leave and the assets that they threaten to move, no. The government said that's going to be a process. We're going to look into that. We're going to keep jobs here. If there's part of that money that you've gotten benefits and subsidies and tax breaks, fine. We're taking those back. What's left, you can take with you. You even broach such a thing, and I think you would find that corporations and the rich will rethink the arrogance of responding to what a democratic population wants by the threat to refuse to participate. It's a little bit like having a young person be told it's a democratic obligation for you to give 2 years of public service after we've publicly educated you, and the individual says, oh, you make me do that, I'll leave and go to another country. Not so quick. Not so quick. You don't evade your social responsibilities in a self-serving manner like that. That's not democratic responsibility. Thank you very much for your attention. This has been a wonderful program. I want to thank Dr. Harriet Fraud again for joining us. This is Economic Update, and I look forward to meeting with you again next week.
Got the blues.